Hello, Central. This is Chuck Shaden on Those Were the Days, calling Ralph Edwards in Hollywood. Are you there, Ralph?
I'm here, Chuck, and it's mighty happy I am to talk with you and your WLTD-FM group.
Thank you very much. We're calling to say hello from all your fans in the Chicago area who watch you on This Is Your Life every Sunday night at 6:30 on Channel 7, WLS-TV.
Well, may I return my felicitations to them and thank them for watching. Chicago has always been a very strong area for us, even back through the days of Truth or Consequences when I did it. And This Is Your Life and all the area around whole northwestern Illinois and all around in there.
Well, great. We'd like to turn the tables, if we can, on you just this once, Ralph, and through the magic of the long-distance telephone, present This Is Your Life, Ralph Edwards.
Okay. It's liable to be your dullest show, Chuck.
I'm sure it won't be. We have our own special leather-covered scrapbook here, but it needs the master's touch to make it complete, so perhaps you'll fill in all the empty pages as we chat.
Well, I don't know about being the master, but I'll sure try to be a good researcher for you.
All right. Remember one thing, Ralph. If you don't tell the truth, you'll have to pay the consequences.
Yeah, I like that kind of talk, too, Chuck.
You were a Colorado farm boy, right, who studied to be an English teacher.
Well, that's right. I was born on a farm 13 miles east of Sterling, Colorado, the county seat of Logan County, and nearer to a town called Merino, M-E-R-I-N-O, named after the Merino sheep that used to be there. It used to be called Fort Buffalo because of the buffalo that were there. And we had a little farm near the South Platte River on which I was born, my middle brother and I. My oldest brother was not born there. And then we got a homestead another 2.5 miles out into the dry lands of northeastern Colorado, and we lived on that for 5 years. You had to live on it 5 years until you proved it up. Then it became yours, you know.
Uh-huh.
I think we sold it for about $500 when we all left to go to California.
Mm-hmm. When you did get to California, I think you got started at quite an early age, didn't you, in your script writing?
That's very true. I had always been interested in writing, even on the farm. I used to make up plays. We go around to the neighboring farms, little pals of mine, and we'd put on shows. And then when I got in the first grade there, Miss Effie, who was my teacher in Merino, I still correspond with her and see her from time to time. She's living near Denver now, but until last year she was in Merino, and I'd always go down to see her and my Aunt Della until they passed away. But at any rate, Miss Effie would put me in charge of making up the plays for the mothers when they'd come to visit us in first grade, and this whetted my enthusiasm. When I got to California when I was 12 years of age, I continued this and even wrote the school play for the grammar school for successive years after I'd gone on to high school and then into the University of California. I worked my way through the University of California writing various series for local radio there.
My little leather-covered book here says there's a reference to a 15-minute dramatic show called Alvin and Betty.
Yes, I was still in Oakland High School when I wrote that. It was a 15-minute show a day. The premise of it was married life. It was a treatise on married life. Now, what's a 15-year-old guy going to know about married life? But at any rate, I wrote it, and Alvin and Betty were played by two other people. Al Pacino was Alvin, Carl Bottino, I should say, and he gave me my first paycheck of $1 a script, and I was announcer and wrote it and did all the sound effects. We even had a contest on there to name a goat. I had a goat, you know, I even did the sound effects, and so I asked the listeners if they would write in, tell us what they thought it was a black goat and what it should be named. And Colleen Moore, who was playing in the Church Mouse at the Fulton Theater, was the judge, and she chose the name Anthracite. So that's where you might say the genesis of the Hush contest, the Walking Man contest, and Miss Hush and all those great contests that raised so much money for charity came from.
Colleen Moore, you may know, is a Chicago gal now.
Do indeed. I saw her in our church the other month, I should say, about 2 months ago. We had I go to the Beverly Hills Community Presbyterian Church over here. Matter of fact, I'm going to a committee meeting tonight there. We're having our 50th anniversary of the church, trying to get some things together. Anyhow, They had, as a part of this 50th anniversary, they had the Tuesday nights in May, and King Vidor, the director-producer of films, was there and showed some of his great past movies, and Colleen Moore was seated in the front, and I went up afterwards and said, "Do you remember me?" And one thing I bet you don't remember is my coming up to you as a young high school student in Oakland and asking you to judge a contest. She's a lovely girl. She was on one of our This Is Your Life.
Yeah, yeah. So let's back up again to continue our version of This Is Your Life, Ralph Edwards. After you earned all you could in California, especially at $1 a week for a script there, $1 a script, you tried to get a job on the stage in New York, didn't you?
Yes. When I graduated from the University of California, mm-hmm. I went from the station in which I'd worked all during my days at the University of California in Berkeley, KROW and KTAB, which later became the call letters KSFO. I went from there over to KFRC in San Francisco, which was a CBS outlet at that time. And, I heard those guys say, "This is the Columbia Broadcasting System," and then I'd have to open the microphone and give the call letters. And I said, "Well, I can do what they're doing back there." Mm-hmm. And maybe I'll get up enough nerve to go back there sometime. About that time, I got a card from Sam Taylor, who was the editor of our humor magazine at Cal, a thing called The Pelican. And he had seen me in Little Theater. I was knee-deep in Little Theater work on the stage there at Cal. And he had seen me, and when he went back to New York, he wrote this note saying, "If you can get back here, I'll get you a walk-on in a Broadway play." Well, I got the ride back, two or three rides back, and the last of which was from Philadelphia on in and to that big city of New York. But when I got back there, the show, it didn't run even. It died a morning. But I was in New York, and then I lined up with the boys at the stage entrance and the girls there, and I thought, well, this is going a little slow, so I'll go to what I know, which is radio. And I went over and auditioned all around, and I finally got on as an announcer at CBS.
I understand that within 2 years from that time, you were one of the highest-paid radio announcers in the country.
Well, here's the way it worked. It took 2 years. I had more shows than any commercial announcer in radio. I don't know if anybody's come up to that number yet. There were 45 shows a week, but I was getting $45 a week as just my sustaining salary at the CBS station. So the radio announcers and producers formed a union called AGRAP, the American Guild of Radio Announcers and Producers, and they cited me as a case. "Look, this kid's got all these shows, and look what he's getting paid." And I said, "Now, look, leave me alone. I starved in this city. I know what it is. I'm happy as I am. I don't want to get mixed up in any union thing." And they said, "No, go ahead and do it." Well, then AGRAP went on for a while, and I actually lost money because, sure, they would pay me for the number of hours that I worked on a show, but they would take that out of my sustaining salary. So I'd end up with about $43 or $42 at the end of a week. So when AFRA, not AFTRA, but AFRA came in, then they had this big thing that you got X amount of dollars. I've forgotten what it was. And, of course, a show with my 45 shows by, wow, bonanza, you know?
Yeah, I'll see. Must have been great. You were doing, some of the programs that you were doing or checking are This Is Your Life leather-covered book on Ralph Edwards.
Plug Bonanza. It's not on the ABC station. I mean, End of the Rainbow.
Right.
There's one that was mine that flunked, so I can say that.
Well, you did Life Can Be Beautiful, didn't you?
Right. I announced Life Can Be Beautiful for, I guess until I gave up all my shows. I had Life Can Be Beautiful, Against the Storm, Road of Life, The O'Neills, Vic and Sade, the Emily Post Show, the Tony Wan Show. There's a bit of memorabilia. I gave them all up, and an announcer by the name of Art Stark inherited them all. They made these announcers listen to all these things that I said, and, they copied the way of doing it. I had a kind of a throwaway thing. "Now, look, girls, you don't have to listen if you don't want to. If you don't want to have the smoothest, most beautiful hands in town, what the heck with it? Turn me off, will you?" But, you know, in other words, I just chatted with them and developed a kind of a style. This was when Godfrey was just starting to come out of Washington. And So the style hit, and I got a lot of shows off of it, but they made these poor guys try to imitate me when I went off. Art Stark came the closest to it, and so he took over. But I did Life Can Be Beautiful for a great many years. I enjoyed it with Alice Reinhart and Ralph Locke and many other wonderful people. Oh, and Vic and Sade came out of Chicago. I announced them in New York, Chuck.
No kidding.
I never, to this day, and I never will now, of course, seen Vic and Sade. I met Rush, the boy, you know, but
Idleson. Billy Idleson?
Billy Idleson. I met him at a restaurant out here one time during the war, and I walked up to him, and I said, I'm Ralph Edwards, and he says, I'm Billy Idleson. I said, I know, and this, could you imagine, we were on the show together 2 years and never saw each other because you were in Chicago. I announced from New York because I was doing most of the Procter & Gamble shows.
Did you have anything to do with the Major Bowes original amateur hour as an announcer?
Yes. I was the announcer of that for 4 years. I think Jimmy Wallington started. Could have been Graham McNamee, but I think it was Jimmy Wallington. And then Dan Seymour took it over. Dan, you know, is a great head of a big agency now. And then John Allen Wolf took it over. And then when I came in, I don't know, just things hit. I got that show. A lot of funny things happened to me on that show. I had the hiccups one time, the very first show that I was on. And I was living up in a one-room room up overlooking Grant's Tomb on 125th Street, Riverside Drive in New York. I had a towel in the window, the broken window. You know, I'd just come off Poverty Row there. And by the time I got down to the show, I was excited and hiccuping, and I said, "Does anybody know how to stop hiccups?" And the guy said, "Well, go around to the soda fountain just around the corner and get yourself a glass of water." I said, "Okay, now I'll be right back. I'll be right back, I promise you." So I went on. I said, "Listen, if you give me a glass of water." So the fellow, instead of putting the water, put the fizz water. He turned it the other way, you know, like he was making an ice cream soda. Mm-hmm. So I drank this thing. Now I've really got a tornado going in. Now you're killing me, you know. So I go back, and I say to the producer, Paul Laporte, I said, "Okay, I'm all set." He says, "You can't go on with the hiccups." I said, "You just go ahead." So I walked up on the stage. All the people used to sit in the front row who were connected with the show, the producer, the director, and so on. I sat there, too. And the major sat up at his table with the gong and the hammer that he hit it with. Okay, the producer gives the signal from the control booth, and I'm thinking, how am I going to get over these hiccups? The major hits the gong, and I say, "Four great cars, Plymouth, Dodge, DeSoto, and Chrysler, bring you Major Bowes and his original amateur hour." Went right on, Chuck. I never had a hiccup the rest of the show.
Beautiful. You couldn't have dreamed up a deal like that.
Well, you know, nerves will sometimes get you, but I don't know. I've been in the business so long, I go to sleep on pianos. During Life Can Be Beautiful, can you believe? I had so many shows, because at night I would do the Ben Bernie show, the Hit Parade, the Phil Baker show, 99 Men and a Girl, just a whole mess up there, with repeats, if you please.
Mm.
You know, we would do two shows then, because there was no such thing as tape or recording.
Yeah.
And I was pooped out, so during my daytime shows, I would go to sleep, and I'd tell Bill Meader, the organist, after I got through with my announcing and his playing the theme, I said, "Now, if I'm not awake a minute before Chi-Chi and Papa David have stopped hitting each other, well, you wake me up." And I would go to sleep on that piano, and I still can control myself pretty much that way. You have to in this business. No more hiccups.
Well, that's great. If you care to hiccup during this program, we're happy to have you.
Thank you, Chuck. You're very hospitable.
Didn't you do a show, a local show in New York for the Automat?
Yes, the Horn and Hard Art Automat cafeterias are where you put the nickel in at that time. Now you put more money in, of course, and you get the pie or the whatnot, sandwiches and everything else. They had a children's hour, the Horn and Hard Art Children's Hour, and Paul Douglas, the actor, then an announcer, had done the show for 6 years. I took over from him, and when I gave it up after I sold Truth or Consequences, started out with that, I gave it up, and Ed Herlihy took it over. He announces for Kraft, you know, and all that. And Lever Brothers, I think, too, has it. And the result was that, Ed had the show for 20 years, I think.
The whole program lasted, I think, for some 29 years.
Yes, a lot of the kids off of that are now grown men. Some of them, I think, are senators and presidents and rahas and everything else.
Well, you mentioned Truth or Consequences, and, of course, we'd certainly like to talk about that program, that great, great brainchild of yours. How did you, it was a new concept in radio quiz programs, and how did you get the idea for it?
Well, the idea sprang from some of the games we used to, or a game we used to play on the farm in Colorado called Heavy, Heavy Hangs Over Thy Head, or Fine or Super Fine. You'd take an object from one of the people playing, and you'd hold it over the person's head who was it. You'd be behind them. They couldn't see what it was. If they guessed it were super fine, a girl's object, okay, they wouldn't have to pay the consequences. But if they... if it were, in reality, in fact, a male object, like a jackknife or a slingshot or whatever you'd have on the farm, and they hadn't said fine, then they had not told the truth, so they'd have to pay the consequences, which was usually to kiss the girl or do some crazy little thing.
Uh-huh.
And you couldn't say shine her shoes or put her shoes on because we were all barefooted, you know. But when I got to having so many shows that I got seeing box tops in front of my eyes. And, well, if I can think of a show where I only had to work once a week instead of all that time, okay. So I got to thinking quiz shows were the trend of the time, but I thought, well, one quiz show is enough. Can you imagine that? There must be 50,000 now.
Yeah.
But let's get a different slant. Let's do the old penalty angle of the consequences. And so I just jazzed it up more and made it... more adaptable to pranks and stunts and that sort of thing. Of course, as time went on, we put the nostalgia or the heart into it, and there's your life mm-hmm. from that.
Can you, I've recalled a few of the silly questions you used to ask and then never gave enough time to the contestant to answer it.
Right.
Do you think you might pull a memory out of there with an answer if I try to quiz you with one of these?
Some of them, the reason they were crazy and unanswerable is because the audience didn't like it when the people answered the questions because they'd never get to see them do the consequences.
Yeah.
Then, you see. Well, let's see. One of them is what famous band leader made over $30,000 in one night's work? And they all think around. You say Jesse James. You know, he was a famous band leader. Bank there and got all the money.
Why is life insurance like car polish?
What?
Why is life insurance like car polish?
Like car polish.
That's Beulah. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, why?
Because it protects your finish.
Oh, come on. Will you, Chuck? Those are cornier than mine.
That was from yours.
Chuck, that's one of the most brilliant questions I've ever seen. I'm going to give that to Bob Barker and let him and Ed Bailey put it on.
Well, it...
A hole in the carpet to see the floor show. How many wives does the Bible allow? 16. Four richer, four poorer, four better, four worse.
Oh.
You're picking up, huh?
Oh, boy. What about the stunts? You know, it's amazing... amazing how you had so many visual stunts in the days of radio.
Yes. I remember the first review from Variety, our show business Bible, that said, when television comes, Truth or Consequences has to be the number one show because it is so visual. Well, there's a thing about that. Two things. One is, if you honestly do the things, if you say... All right, we're going to blindfold you, Mr. Jones, or Mr. Shaden, whatever. We're going to take you all around New York, and you're going to have to guess where you end up. We'll tune you in where you end up. And then you do just that, and you put a lot of sound effects to it. And he's on his way, and you hear river boats and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And then he ends up on the stage of the Winter Garden Theater where, say, Olsen and Johnson were playing in Hell's a Poppin'.
Uh-huh.
And he's still blindfolded. He guessed that he was on the Normandy or one of the big liners because of the sound effects. And we took off the blindfold, and there he is in front of 1,500 people. And, of course, they blast out and laugh. Or you're at the amphitheater in Chicago playing a food show down there in the stockyard, and you send a guy out with a baby buggy and his friend dressed as a little baby, and the guy starts to talk, and the passerby says, "How cute is the baby?" And the guy takes a cigar out and says, "Yeah, you want to whiff of my cigar?" You know. Now, actually doing that is the license to do it, although it is visual. I mean, radio really came alive with that. The second thing is that your imagination built it even beyond what it might have been sometimes. We might have said, all right, it's George Washington's birthday. Now, Mr. Jones, we want you to climb this tree, and we want you to sing Old MacDonald Had a Farm with these four choruses. Now, if you can finish those four choruses before Mr. Smith over here chops down this cherry tree, you'll win $100. If you don't, you'll fall right into this tub of water. Okay, now the audience has a picture of a tree, a tub of water, a guy chopping, and you hear the chop chop. Even though the tree weren't the biggest tree in the world, or the tub of water, the deepest tub, or the man the greatest singer, or the axe the biggest axe, your imagination, whatever you wanted to make of that act, was okay, you see. We would give it all we could give it, but people, successful, I think, because you could take it beyond the realm of reality and put it into your creative thoughts and make of it whatever you wanted to.
Once again, the imagination of the listener helped to build the magic of radio, didn't it?
You know it, Chuck. This is what, in a way, is lacking in television, unless you have a supernatural or some kind of foggy scrim to your project on television, whatever play you're doing. There is no great imagination. It's spelled out. It's like the movies. It's a different type of storytelling. You are right. Radio made you think.
Absolutely. Let's think a little more about radio and some of those great memorable Truth or Consequences events, Ralph Edwards. You changed the name of a town on your 10th anniversary on radio, didn't you?
Yes, Truth or Consequences, New Mexico now exists. The former Hot Springs, New Mexico, a county seat of Sierra County, halfway between Albuquerque and El Paso on Highway 85. Nice big four-lane freeway now all the way. And Elephant Butte Lake is there, the second largest body of impounded water in the United States of America. How's that for selling the city? I don't get a cent out of it, so don't think it's of the people down there. It's our adopted city, and we just got finished last May with our 22nd annual fiesta. Barbara and I, my mother of my three little consequences, and I go down annually with a group of Hollywood stars and have a good time, and the townspeople turn out, and they come from all over the various states of Southwest and from Chicago, from New York, from all over.
Well, what was the background? Why did Hot Springs, New Mexico, agree to change their name to Truth or Consequences, New Mexico?
Our 10th anniversary of Truth or Consequences, and we were trying to think of something that would shake the people up in America, something that would make them aware of the fact that Truth or Consequences was still going strong. And so I had the writers and I bring in thoughts on what we might do. Al Simon, who is the head of Filmways out here now, was an idea man for me then, and he came up with the idea of changing the name of some town or city to Truth or Consequences. So we sent out feelers to chambers of commerce, and we heard from three different cities who agreed to do it, and the most promising was this county seat of Sierra County, Hot Springs, New Mexico. So I sent Ed Bailey, my producer, down to talk to them, and the result was that we did just that. The city voted to change the name. They voted three times since then to maintain it, to retain it, and now it is permanently Truth or Consequences, New Mexico.
So Truth or Consequences will always be on the map of the United States.
Yes, it has been for 20 years. Rand McNally put it on. The post office, the letterheads are Truth or Consequences. The newspapers, the Truth or Consequences Herald, and so on down the line.
Great. What about some of the great contests from the Truth or Consequences shows, The Walking Man and so forth?
Well, It may be interesting to you, Chuck, and your listeners there over WLTD-FM to know that the reason these contests started was that my building a backfire to something that I started and was sorry I had started. Way back in 41, I brought a young lady out of the audience, chose her in the warm-up, as we do select our contestants, and she was a struggling secretary, and we said, you're going to be Cinderella, and go to the ball, and we gave her a gown and a mink coat and shoes and hairdo, and I always said, this is from I.J. Fox mink coat, this is Saks Fifth Avenue dress, these are I. Miller shoes, this is Charles of the Ritz hairdo, and I didn't get them free for doing that. I just wanted the audience to know these were quality goods.
Uh-huh.
And then we brought her back at the end of the show. She looked beautiful. I said, here's your Prince Charming. It was before the war, but the armory was aboard up there. A National Guardsman took her up, a lieutenant, to the ball. And she went out. I said, oh, by the way, all the dress and the mink coat and everything else, the handbag and the money, are yours to keep. Well, the listeners thought that was real great, and the other packagers of shows and producers thought it was great too. But you see, they didn't take the heart; they just stole the bones or something. I don't know what they did, but they got to the point finally around 1945 or 46, and they said, "Right, Grant is buried in Grant's tomb. You have won the Cadillac sedan." So it was just terrible. The giveaway craze, as you remember, got to be nonsense. So I thought, well, yes, inadvertently, we started this. How will we stop it? So one night on Truth and Consequences, 1945, I think it was, out here, 46, I said, well, I'm sorry, you haven't told the truth, but if you can tell me who Mr. Hush is, you will win. And it was a big satire. I thought I was satirizing this whole giveaway thing. You will win a Cadillac sedan, a house and lot, and a mink coat. And, man, that shook them up. Next week, I added three more fantastic things, a yacht, a year's supply of nylon hose, which the post-war was very difficult to get, and things like that. They started flying in from Boston, New Orleans, and they'd raise their greedy little hands, and I thought, now what have I done? I've got all these people here and they're getting this loot for nothing. When they guess off, Mr. Hush, I'll make it work for some good, which has been the theme of Truth or Consequences all through its 32 years of existence, Chuck, to turn the big things into something good. At any rate, they guessed Mr. Hush off as Jack Dempsey. Then we started Mrs. Hush, and that was Clara Bow. I said, okay, I didn't tell them who it was, but I said, now you folks who didn't get a chance, you listeners, with Mr. Hush, you have a chance with Miss Hush. Just send in 25 words or less why we should all support the March of Dimes and try to end the polio epidemic. Include, if you please, a donation. Well, in those contests, we raised over $3 million for the March of Dimes. In the Miss Hush contest, who was Martha Graham, the dancer, we raised $1,639,000 and put the American Heart Association in business coast to coast as a volunteer agency. It was a scientific agency made up of doctors in a few cities. But this made it a cohesive coast-to-coast thing. About every 10 years, they give me a great big testimonial dinner. They did it in Chicago right there at the Hilton one time with former President Hoover giving me the Gold Heart. Out here, President Eisenhower gave me an award just before he died. And now at Disneyland, they have been so rewarding to me in their expression of the start of the American Heart Association coast to coast. I tell them, look, you've done it. That's fine. If it'll help raise more money for heart. Okay. But it was the most powerful thing in rating getter, attention getting, next to the FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt fireside speech and the Joe Louis heavyweight fights, the Hush contest, the Walking Man, Miss Hush and all those, commanded the next to those two broadcast types of broadcasts, the highest rating ever rung up in radio in those days, Chuck.
It's amazing, and people still talk about it. They remember Mr. and Mrs. Hush.
Listen, I got a call from Howard Eaton of Ogilvy and Mather the other day and saying, gee, you know, in the spirit of the old contest, do you suppose, would you ever? I said, no, not on This Is Your Life. Now, that's a different type of show. Truth or Consequences, maybe, but... Yeah. And two, it's very difficult to repeat a pure thing like that.
Yeah.
It was made for the times and all. And now, of course, there are great rules. The NAB has great rules about contributing. We have a tremendous show coming up on This Is Your Life that I would have loved to have done, an appeal, as we call.
Uh-huh.
The young kid who is in South Vietnam, and he's taking the kids off the street, the wanderers of the street, the 9 to 15-year-olds, gets them out of jail, and if he saves them one day, he figures he's ahead of the game. He's building hostels and all. It's one of those great stories in the spirit of the little professor of Piney Woods for whom we raised $1 million.
Yeah.
Or Dr. Kate McFarlane, the angel on snowshoes, for whom we built the big wing there in the hospital in Woodruff, Wisconsin, or the Jimmy Fund in Boston, through which the wing on the Children's Hospital appeared there. You know, it's that same type of saintly man almost who is so endowed with God's spirit of sharing oneself with others and giving oneself that it comes across and people want to help. You know, a dollar a whack and a million people, you've got $1 million.
Sure. You know, Ralph Edwards, if we had our a real authentic version of This Is Your Life, Ralph Edwards, we might surprise you with an appearance by Mrs. Florence Hubbard of Chicago.
Yes, of Carson Peary Scott.
You know who she is.
She won the Walking Man contest, the Walking Man contest was the one for the American Heart.
I said
Miss Hush,
yeah.
Who was Martha Graham. It was Jack Benny. Jack was number one when that started with his program. By the end of the contest, 6-7 weeks later, we were number one. He said, "What did I do?" I'm the famous quote. That's what he did to himself. And anyhow, he had Mrs. Hubbard on his show and determined that she was a widow. And he says, "Lonely but loaded." Those prizes, you know. And her house, I am told that she took the rewards from the house, from the prizes, and built a house in Florida and called it on this. The door is a sign. This is the house that Ralph built.
Oh, great!
She's a love. Oh my, we adored her.
How many of the Truth or Consequences shows incorporated the "This Is Your Life" type feature?
Of course, "This Is Your Life," the original, was done on Truth or Consequences, 1946. There was one before that, mm-hmm. in 1945, that had the flavor of This Is Your Life, and really was the seed that sprung into This Is Your Life. We, instead of having the subject on stage, we tuned him in by remote control and in Hawaii and took him to his hometown in North Dakota or somewhere like that, and went into the drugstore, talked to the druggist, went into the church, talked to the minister, went into the school, talked to the teacher, and here they talked two-way communication from his sick bed in the Naval Hospital somewhere.
Did you...
I would guess maybe we have done, 100 acts that are on the This Is Your Life theme, Chuck.
Uh-huh.
On Truth or Consequence.
This Is Your Life then made it as a program on its own in 1948 on radio.
That's right. That's right. I did. I had Harry Von Zell in at first, trying to sell a show with him in it. But they were so Truth or Consequences was so hot and strong a show then, and they wanted me in it. And finally, I sold it. I said, "Okay, I'll do it." But it became increasingly difficult to be a devil on Saturday night or an angel on Wednesday night. You see, So I turned Truth or Consequences, the master of ceremonies chores, over to Jack Bailey first, and then of course I found Bob Barker, which was the greatest thing that has come along to the continent. He's just fantastic.
You did about 2 years on radio before you translated This Is Your Life to television then.
Yes, I did. We did some marvelous shows, some marvelous radio This Is Your Life shows. People still talk about it.
Then on television, it was really a live television program, and the element of surprise was quite an exciting thing.
Yes, well, it still is an exciting thing. In those days, there was no tomorrow. I mean, this was it. This is your life, and we're live. Lowell Thomas, when he said this is a sinister conspiracy, we were on tape then. I don't know if we'd ever continued. Oh, I would have. But he made a shambles out of the show, and our rating went way up, you know, by just sitting around. He's a dear friend of mine, by the way. We belong to the same club together, and we correspond all the time. A lot of people thought that they didn't know what was wrong with him, but I know he's that's Lowell. He hates to have anybody talk about himself, about him.
Uh-huh.
He likes to talk about other people, and that was what he was doing.
Did you have much trouble keeping the subjects from knowing that they were going to be honored?
No, that's the easiest angle of the whole show. The selection is the most difficult. There's so many to choose from, and you only have one a week. Who's it going to be?
I know when you, in the first series, of course, This Is Your Life has a second life now, and it's probably the biggest syndicated program on television today.
A big story in Variety that they mailed to me when I was up fishing. Barbara and I went up to Colorado, I think I told you, to our fishing ranch up there. And the story was, boy, a big one in Variety, saying that This Is Your Life is number one and Truth or Consequence is number two in syndication.
Still going strong after, well, more than 30 years, I think.
Amazing. I guess you're just going to have to take their livers out and beat them to death. But I hope they go on forever.
Did you have some, I read someplace that you used a code name for the subject so someone wouldn't inadvertently spill the beans.
Yes, that's very true. You know, Joe Frazier coming up, we called him Braun. I can't think of too many of them. Now, you know, you put it in your mind, it's like the FBI. It's your mind says, don't say it. But, of course, it's over now. I could say it, but...
You have a June Allison coming up, I think.
Yes. It has played out here already.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if it's played in Chicago. Maybe it plays this week. But if it hasn't played there, see it. She is delightful. She looks beautiful. She looks exactly as she did when she stepped onto the screen a few years back.
Well, Ralph Edwards, your life has been one of making people happy, and for over 30 years, your efforts in bringing fun and sentiment to millions and millions of radio TV listeners has been a great reward for viewers and listeners, and what greater reward can you have than to continue to do what you do so well?
Thank you, Chuck Shaden, very much. I'm honored to have this spot on your show. I believe in tomorrow, but I also believe in yesterday, and that's kind of what your show is all about. I think blending the two is a good idea.
Well, thank you. We'll be watching Channel 7 here in the Chicago area every Sunday night for more of This Is Your Life, and we thank you for sharing your memories with us today on Those Were the Days.
Thank you, Chuck.